This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, Fuad and I will discuss a classic text or a concept which we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, Fuad, you've got something on propaganda, I believe.
Yeah, and I think it's very relevant too, because when you really think about what propaganda entails, it actually encompasses a great deal of our life. In fact, one can say almost all aspects of our lives, especially we live in what they call the information age, right, where we're always readily accessing some form of media one way or another.
So that's interesting. So now we already have two terms. We have propaganda and we have media. Mm-hmm. And you've made a kind of equivalence, right? And I know that in many circles, propaganda is a negative term. It suggests that the information is not true, or that it's amplified in a way that's, it's exaggerated and therefore distorts reality. But did propaganda begin its life as a term, as a concept, in that fashion?
No, actually. The term propaganda originated from the Latin. I mean, it's a Latin word, but the meaning originally referred to the propagation of Catholic doctrines to missionaries in the Americas at the time. So there was this new conquest that they had to embark on, and the right doctrine had to be espoused. And the Catholic Church used propaganda for that reason, to widen their tentacles into this new area, during the time of Columbus and so forth. So that was the origins, and I think since then it has not taken a positive connotation.
You use the word tentacles, so you brought in another thing that's straight away from the tentacles, yeah. And sort of octopus like.
But I think this is an interesting challenge, right? Because we do want to be objective in our understanding of this. And I think this is something that a lot of scholars in the field acknowledge, that while a great deal of propaganda can be used negatively, there are instances when the message in there can be positive.
Okay, so just going to go back to what you started with. You said propaganda was the name given to the idea of disseminating doctrine. Mm-hmm. So doctrine then is the teachings, the laws,
the theology.
So all that is orthodox, that is accepted by the by authority, is then disseminated in the form of, I don't know, teachings and whatnot, right? So the mass or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so that doesn't sound so bad. So it just says, well, if you're talking about Catholic doctrine, you're saying, well, this is what the Catholic Church stands for, and its missionaries go out and spread the news of that teaching, right? But we're not looking anymore at a single institution and the dissemination of a single doctrine, right? We're now looking at propaganda as being, in fact, the character of a system.
Correct. Although there is a strong strand of propaganda dissemination that comes from a centralized authority. But you're right, it's not reducible to just that, not anymore.
What's also very interesting is, and I remember watching this in that brilliant documentary called The Century of the Self, and it looked at Western Europe just after World War One, and many nations had their propaganda departments, and this was related to the war effort. Mm-hmm. But that war effort had then degraded the meaning of propaganda, now related to the state rather than church. And in its place came the word or the notion of public relations.
Correct.
So public relations takes over from propaganda. Mm-hmm. And because then the documentary, which I think is everybody should watch, talks about the role of Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, as the person who helped shape the initial parameters of public relations and advertising.
Correct. In that, we can find one of the key uneasiness that people have with propaganda, in that it is by nature selfish, in that there is a propagandist behind it, whether it takes the form of a church, the state, or certain individuals engineering these messages, that ultimately the message is never neutral, that somebody looks to gain from the dissemination of those messages. And that is where much of the theoretical suspicion towards propaganda, its form and content, comes from, in that there's always a source, and there's always a source that looks to benefit from you acquiescing to that message.
Now, that's interesting, because you could also imagine a system that is propaganda-like, that has multiple sources, that in fact is in some ways propaganda is best when it is invisible to you as propaganda. So as a good friend of mine, you know, Ray Langenbach, who's an art historian and performance artist, likes to do, and one of his works is in fact the talking about information systems as propaganda systems, is the dissemination of propaganda in kind of invisible form, so that you look at Hollywood film and you think you're watching a film, you think of the director, you think of the scriptwriter as being, but actually what speaks through the film is something much larger. It is assumptions about the world and such.
And does the unconscious, quote unquote, plays a real interesting role here, in that in the example of a Hollywood blockbuster, the director might not be even seeing himself as a propagandist. He might just see himself as an artist. But unbeknownst to him, a part of the larger sort of flow of culture and information that comes from the West, for example, right? So you're right that it's invisible to the audience, sometimes even invisible to those who partake in making it possible. Yeah.
Now, what do we have in terms of texts or authors to kind of anchor this discussion?
Well, there's this textbook that's really good. It's called Propaganda and Persuasion by Garth S. Jowett and Victoria O'Donnell. And it's a good overview of what propaganda is, so different types of propaganda, different manifestations, different historical periods in which propaganda took shape, and also events that correlate with certain major moments in propaganda. I think the one that you mentioned, right, the war effort as being central to propaganda, is really key. But one of the interesting takes that one can get from this text is that the clear assumption that advertising is always the best example of how propaganda works. The authors will always go back to that, you know. And of course, usually by instinct, we think of propaganda in political terms, right? But just the fact that our everyday lives are infused by advertising means that we're constant consumers of propaganda. And this has various ramifications on a lot of things, right?
Like so many things that are ubiquitous, right? We often have a problem with definitions. How do we define what propaganda is that might differentiate it from something else? Are there any adequate definitions of propaganda out there?
Jowett and O'Donnell gives a pretty decent definition, but it's still very elastic, because they admit that propaganda is a very, very wide and sometimes ambiguous phenomena, right? So this is their definition. Propaganda is a deliberate systemic attempt to shape perceptions, manipulate cognitions, and direct behavior to achieve response that furthers the desired intent of the propagandist. Yeah, so there are many elements there, right? There's deliberation, there's a system, right, that when they say a systemic attempt, there's also the desire to shape perceptions and also manipulate cognition. So there are many, many prongs to this.
And do you have to, is it like a checklist? Do you have to hit all those bits
one way
in
or
order
another.
To
yep.
for it to be propaganda?
Yeah.
So what happens when there is no person or institution standing behind this effort? If the intention is not embodied in a person, can we still talk about propaganda if it's sort of everywhere?
It might not be embodied in a person. So the propagandist here does not necessarily mean a person. It could be an institution. It could be a board of directors in a corporation. It need not be centered on any particular individual, sort of, you know, pulling strings, as it were. So in that sense, the book also recognizes that our understanding of the source of propaganda must be refined and complex as well, because in a capitalist world, there's no real source of all capital, right? Everybody partakes in it one way or another. It mutates in its own forms in different contexts. So propaganda, I guess we can say, works the same way.
Often definitions come from looking at or distilling from a particular historical experience, some sense of the inner dynamic of a phenomena, right? So with these two authors, do you have a sense of what kind of historical experience has gone into the mix that created or helped shape this formulation or definition?
Largely a contemporary one, a recent 20th century one. Most of the examples come from there. But also they make references to prior instances, such as the Catholic doctrine example is one good example. But the running thread in all cases is that it's a power game in many ways. It's a tug of war on how one can influence the masses as much as possible, right? I mean, every individual out there sees the world in their own distinct individual ways. But power requires some level of uniformity among the people so that they can be more manageable, so that there can be more order, so on and so forth. And given the availability of media, propaganda is the best way to ensure that conformity. So this is why they emphasize the direction of behaviors to achieve specific responses. So it's not like singing a song can't be propagandistic necessarily, because the goal might just be to entertain, right? But if you're singing a song to ensure that people vote a certain way, to ensure that people stop smoking, to ensure people buy a product, then it becomes propaganda. So the element of conformity behind a message.
Or behavioral change. There.
Correct.
Now,
yeah.
Okay, so again, we get into this really sticky or rather tricky question of how do messages turn into action, mm-hmm. and whether we can in fact put our finger on it, because it's not clear that a message will have a direct impact. It's not like, you know, I say to my, you know, pet cat, stop, and they stop. Or mm-hmm. I tell a child, don't hold that, it's hot, right? The messages we're talking about are of a nature that maybe shape your disposition. It might not have a direct, it's not an order.
Yeah.
It's in fact something that changes the way you look at the world.
I'm smirking because, you know, those things you mentioned harks back to some of the ads that we saw during the election. Some of them are just terrible, right? And you watch, like, who's this influencing, right? Whose behavior is this changing because it's just so bad? Yeah, so it doesn't always translate to that. Yeah,
yeah. So then if you can't tell, you know, whether a message has a direct effect on behavior, how do you then ascribe to it its propaganda effect? What are we talking about if we want to talk about a propaganda effect?
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point, because the authors acknowledge that because a great part of the endeavor is speculative, then propaganda will always, there will always be propaganda for that reason. Because there's only so much you can herd people into doing at a certain given time. And it could fail, it could backfire. And there is an awareness in the system itself that that is the case. So in many ways, it reminds me of Gramsci's theory of hegemony, right? In the sense that there's only so much that hegemony can do. Right, because there's always spaces of resistance somewhere. And that hegemony at some point will get complacent and so on and so forth. And similarly, I think you can draw analogies with the propaganda industry in that they're aware that at any given point, there will be those who are not convinced. Right, and the Soviet example is always good. And the book lists a lot of those. And that the more, you know, the more ostentatious it becomes, the more reason you have to question if it's really working, right? Because it shows a certain level of overcompensation among the authorities.
And I think you can see this every day. And we just come through two major patriotic events,
yes,
where there is, and I think the words that you stole right from my mouth is, you know, overcompensation. You know, it seems that there's an inverse relationship between you know, the kind of claims being made for the state and its reality to people on the ground. Mm-hmm. So, you know. But before we go into the next part, maybe you could tell us just the different things that we're going to be looking at today in terms of propaganda.
Sure. Well, what I'd like to talk about later is how it's experienced. I think we often think of information and the whole process of presentation and reception as distinct from us, as separate from us. And I think it's important to note that, you know, it's not a separate entity out there. We're sort of swimming in it every day. So that's one thing we can look at. And also the some of the different types of propaganda that Joe and O'Donnell talks about. such as integrative, agitative, and then white and black propaganda. So maybe a quick overview of those concepts.
Great. Coming up shortly is a part two of the show. We're going to be looking at the question of propaganda. You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahman, myself, Sharad Kutan. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me is Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and this is Night School, and we're talking about propaganda. Fuad, you have a textbook in front of you, in fact, and I did want to start, before you got into the stuff that you sort of signaled the end of the part one, I did want to ask you, is there something that's not propaganda? Is it news? Is it genuine communications? You know, what is it that's not propaganda?
It's hard. It's hard to find something that's not propaganda, especially because the definition is just so elastic. It can count a lot of things. And especially if we're living in a time now where we're just completely inundated by media. Maybe I can imagine a time not too long ago when one can find spaces that's neutral from propaganda. And I think one can be technical and say, for as long as it doesn't fit this definition that I just read, then it doesn't count propaganda. But I would go so far as to say that, you know, we are in many ways submerged in a world that's propagandistic. However, I must qualify that's within the kind of urban context that our listeners are in. You can probably find, some subsistent agricultural community out there, you know, that's not so bound by pressures of the nation or pressures of the state, that may have more spaces to maneuver around propagandistic elements.
Again, yeah. Imagine about 2 billion people across the world who do not live their lives through Facebook.
And I want again, you know, it's through. I was referring to our context, the listeners of BFM. Yeah.
Okay, this is very okay. I wanted to bring up Facebook because I think a lot of people who are on Facebook, like myself, and you know, because we have our Night School on Facebook, believe that the communications they have through Facebook are not only genuine but are interactive in the best sense of that word, meaning that you are communicating directly with the people that you think you're communicating with, and that this is basically an open system, mm-hmm. right, of communication. It's very mm-hmm. democratic, and it's horizontal, and it's against the older forms of media that are vertical and mm-hmm. and non-interactive and top-down. Now, would you say that communications on Facebook or the act of being immersed in the Facebook world is somehow outside the propaganda effect?
No.
Or is it also part of it?
It's also part of it. In fact, it would just be a good example of how smart propaganda has become. I was at a presentation by Jack S.M. Key. She has a lot of all these data and statistics she has available about, you know, internet use and so on and so forth. And you're correct to say that a great deal of the world still isn't, you know, part of that. So the first effect of that propaganda is to think that you're part of a kind of a connected world community, when you are in fact not. You're just really in this circuit of people of a certain setting. But the other interesting thing is that what we don't know is that Facebook is actually tracking our behavior, our likes, the kind of articles that we post. And from that, it keeps connecting us with our friends who have those things in common with us. And in that, it builds a certain picture of the world for us, right? So if you're into Malaysian Insider articles with the word Anwar in it, you know, it will do its thing to connect us with other people who are reading stuff about Anwar, who are also reading stuff about Malaysian Insider. And if you are liking groups that are more opposition leaning, then the whole kind of Facebook cosmos will be designed to fit this tendencies that you have.
This is very interesting. I love the word that you use, cosmos. So this cosmos is not simply about creating a comfort zone for you. It's about selling something as well, right?
Yeah. And interestingly enough, it shapes, I mean, it falls into this definition of shaping perceptions, in that, you know, if I compare my BN friends' Facebook habits, for example, what they get from Facebook is the idea that it was not surprising that BN won. You know, because everything that she could gather from online, which is essentially Facebook, tells her that it was an imminent BN victory.
So this is one single BN friend that you have, you just mentioned.
A few others too in my family, right? And the same experience, but in the PR version, was felt by my friends from the PR camp.
We're not talking about public relations, we're talking about
Pakatan Rakyat. Correct. Who felt, you know, indignant because they had lost, because they had, based on their experience of online sentiments, they thought they would, you know, it was a sure thing, right? But this, the point here is that we often think of our Facebook interaction as an indicator of what's going on out there, when it's actually shaping and presenting the world in a certain way for us, right?
Because they didn't know at that point how important advance voting was going to be to the outcome. But coming back to the question, so this is interesting, because what you're kind of suggesting is that we have to be really alert our immersion in this space, because things that you might see is kind of, it's kind of intuitive to say, well, Facebook is really propaganda. You're in a propaganda zone when you're in Facebook, right? Okay, so you actually mentioned three or so definitions.
Yeah, but I think I want to build on this point that you made, in that we cannot assume that propaganda is outside of us. You know, that really our everyday interactions, the way we look at the world is shaped by a very sophisticated and complex propagandistic machinery. And that it's a question of subjectivity. It's the kind of person that you're becoming that's really at stake here, not necessarily detecting the sources. And I think that's a lot of the liberal impulse to say, aha, you know, it's coming from BN, I knew it, it's a lie, you know. But no, that's not the point. The point here is there's a larger picture here. You're just submerged in it, and that's where resistance comes. Not in dissecting statements or dissecting images, but in really seeing how it influences you. I was at a concert the other day, and I mean, it was the Smashing Pumpkins Good Vibes music festival. It's essentially an advertising festival, right? And I could tell at that point it is a part of that propaganda machinery that we're talking about.
But you enjoyed yourself nevertheless.
I had a good time, and see, that's how powerful it is. It can give you a good time.
Yeah, I mean.
So, but because, and then you don't think of it, because you think of it as going to a concert, you're paying a ticket to see a band, but no, it's just an advertising festival that happens to be featuring a band, a few bands, yeah.
One of the things I think that is very interesting in terms of the shaping of our consciousness is not so much about the content, or whether we support this party or that party. It's really about the idea that as individuals, we are determining our trajectory in the world, that somehow we are the power, we are the subject making decisions. And I think there are many theorists who have been sort of kind of working against that grain, looking at the idea of the subject, of the individual, that's somehow an effect of structure, right? And so you have the Althusserians and all that who kind of work on this. And we, one of these days, really have to do look at the work of structuralists that way in terms of the question of individuals. But the very idea that we are determining it. I remember, you know, years ago watching an Oprah Winfrey show where somebody comes on who's actually in his analysis of consumer habits said there are actually 17 types of Americans. And what he does is he can go into a home and just by looking at some of the products that are available in the living room, tell you what's in your fridge, you know, in your kitchen. And people were often taken aback, not because it seemed like magical that he could do that, but that somehow they were not individuals anymore. They were actually a niche within a kind of marketing strategy that they, for some reason, had become trained to view the world or have consumer habits of a particular sort. So it's patterned. And of course, this all relates to the way in which things are produced. You know, we have mass production, and for mass production to work, you have to have mass consumption. But in order for the system to work as a whole, you need predictability in both the production and the consumption of goods. And that's actually also the start of, you know, the very idea of that documentary I mentioned earlier, which is, you know, the century of the self. It really is a society, a mass society, with its attendant economic and social structures.
Yeah, I agree. On one hand, we have to detect the sources of information, how they're produced, but also the larger context in which there must be a need for that kind of information to begin with. So it's not contained necessarily to the media, but also to larger, you know, superstructures that we're a part of. Production, consumption, labor, what we do in our spare time, you know, all that is connected. And in that sense, yeah, when you talk about propaganda, it's really just the shell of something, a larger core at work. Yeah.
So what do we have now in terms of the textbook and what it lays out?
So Joe and O'Donnell, in introducing propaganda, listed some different types. So there's integrative propaganda and agitative propaganda. Integrative propaganda essentially renders an audience passive. It renders them non-challenging. Whereas agitative propaganda does the opposite, attempts to rouse an audience to a certain goal, certain outcome or significant change. And agitative propaganda is, I mean, one good example would be wartime propaganda. We haven't had much of it here in our context. Perhaps Lahat Datu would be the most recent example, where propaganda is more passionate, essentially. It's calling on more primal sentiments of belonging, of togetherness, of nation,
But it's not mobilizing us for a draft.
Doesn't have to.
Yeah,
because you
can remember the ads that were patriotic ads that ran in the cinemas most recently, which were, it seemed, referenced to Lahat Datu.
In Malaysia?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
You haven't been to the cinema recently.
Not recently,
yeah. and it was interesting because in those, it really is about creating a feeling of oneness with those who had sacrificed their lives to protect the state.
But there was a draft in there?
No, there wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Because we have a standing army. You see, we need a draft. But you can imagine how different that would be
if the
war effort was larger, we were suddenly thrust into a greater thing.
I think it would have been, it would have been logical consequences.
Right.
Yeah.
So there you have a situation on one hand that seems kind of passive because basically they just want us to immerse ourselves in a particular sentiment of patriotism or love for the army and for military men and this kind of thing, but at some maybe deeper level, it might be a call to something, though it's not very clear what that call is.
Sure, sure. I think in our case, the integrative, more passive propaganda that I can think of is the photo behind all our textbooks. You didn't go to school here, but a lot of the Sekolah Menengah textbooks at the back will have a photo of the standard Malaysian portrait. There'll be the Malay, the Indian, the Chinese, and there'll always be a Sikh in there, you know. But there won't be many indigenous people or East Malaysians, but there'll always be a Sikh there.
What is that supposed to be?
It's supposed to say, you know, Malaysia is a harmonious country.
Okay, so that is not agitated.
It's not. And it doesn't, it's done in monochrome. It's at the back of a textbook. Right. And it's telling you to feel safe. It's telling you to, like, okay, things are good, you know, everything's fine. And just keep on reading this textbook, you know. So that would be one. And, you know, like wash your hands before you eat at the garai or something like that. You know, that would be agitative, right?
That's agitative.
Oh, no, sorry, excuse me, integrative, yeah.
Okay, so that's integrative, okay?
Although it should be agitative in our context.
Yeah, because it's a call to action, right? So, and that's interesting.
Oh, but no, integrative calls for action too, but it's not as rousing, yeah.
Ah,
yeah.
Yeah.
All of them are calling to action.
I see.
Yeah, all of them do that, yeah.
So all of them have a call to action embedded in the message.
Correct.
Right, okay. So
even when you say, this is a good point that the author made, even when you say don't act, it's a call to action.
Yeah. Because it's calling you
choose
to
an action. Choose,
okay. Yep. Choose passivity. Choose not to act on your feelings or whatever.
Choose the status quo. Things. Choose not to change anything. Yeah.
Okay. So, what does this this categorization of different types of propaganda help us understand about the nature of propaganda?
Oh, the many manifestations it can take. It doesn't always have to come in a very aggressive form, and I think that's one thing we have to keep in mind because our immediate connection with propaganda is often to think that it's aggressive or it's shoving something down your throat. It doesn't have to.
So what else do we have that's covered in this textbook?
Oh, well, there's two more types which I think illustrate different forms of propaganda. And I don't like this term. Maybe it's my politically correct American education or something, but they differentiate it as white propaganda and black propaganda. White propaganda is propaganda with accurate information, and black propaganda as less accurate, as
Or like as disinformation? Manipulative
as disinformation, correct.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, yeah, it's sort of like white lie and actually.
Well, no, actually, it's slightly different. Because a white lie is actually a lie told for the good of something, yeah. Right? So that the intention is honorable.
Sure, sure.
But the modality is one of manipulation, yeah. Or, you
but
know, what
the,
about
the association with white with good is, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, so I that's just, your political view.
I just don't like it because, yeah.
Okay, what would be an example of white propaganda? I'm just trying to figure out that one.
Well, if a government is listing statistics that are reliable from the UN or something about its achievements, you know, and saying we've done well according to the UN. That's white propaganda.
Ah, yeah. So, okay. But why didn't call it propaganda? Why didn't you just call it facts or
because,
truth?
Because the government would have an interest in ensuring that people know how well it's doing.
Okay, yes. So by being invested in the communications and information, then you are engaging in propaganda, whether it's truthful or not.
Correct, correct. For as long as you're achieving a response that furthers the desired intent of propaganda. So there's information is never done for free in that sense.
Oh, in a kind of disinterested fashion.
Correct. Correct.
Now that's difficult for me because I'm thinking so much of a communications between individuals, you know, is invested. So I tell you something because I want you to help you. I want you to help me out. I want to help you out. I want to, you know, our friends to be helped. Is that propaganda too? Is it interpersonal communication?
Right? I mean, among friends, there's no measuring. There's no measuring of the anticipation, right?
Well, I don't know about that.
But I mean, that's an expectation. There's no measuring. Propaganda is a bit more impersonal in that way, right? There's like a particular thing that you want them to do. Votes, consumption, stopping smoking, washing hands before you had the garage. You know, it's a bit more calculated in that sense.
Right. So propaganda can still be used to characterize interpersonal communications, or is it a notion that is limited to certain forms of institutional relationships with individuals? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Kind of it's more, yeah. I think, yeah, it definitely the discourse is aiming at the larger structure rather than individual. It wouldn't discount the fact that certain interpersonal communication will be affected by propaganda. But the essence of it is not that. And also, there is an element of manipulation. Even in white propaganda, there's always an element of manipulation there. Even though the facts are correct, the presentation of the facts, how the colors to present that facts are chosen, how whose face you put next to the facts, when those facts are disseminated, all of that is to a certain degree manipulative. So while we can say that quote-unquote white propaganda is good propaganda, it's not without those quote-unquote manipulative elements.
Okay,
yeah.
So
never information in the public is never neutral.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's the message.
That's the message. What else do they...
Well, the other one is black propaganda,
all right,
which is manipulative. I think this is the one that we always think of when we think of propaganda.
So here we have what is very interesting. It's kind of you have the work laying out a system, right? Kind of characterizing different ways in which information flows that might be adequately described as propaganda. But in many ways, it's a description that can be completely all-encompassing. It's like there's no space outside of it. I mean, if I want to talk, if I want to communicate on a public level, if I want to think about the way in which a government might communicate with the citizenry that is not propagandistic, is it possible? Is there a space outside propaganda systems that we can imagine possible?
I don't know if we need to go outside of it, right? We can use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. And you see a lot of that. You see a lot of people using YouTube to mock the government, for example, you know, and in a way that is very propagandistic, in a way that presents a counter message to what's dominant.
So now we get into this thing about we come back to the Facebook discussion because there's a lot of dissenting views on Facebook. But Facebook will use that similar thing to kind of recode it as in a way that will sell the system to you again in different ways. So are we caught in this endless loop? We're thinking we're resisting, but we're actually caught, supporting the very system that we in some ways ultimately want to overthrow.
Even a lot of information about Facebook's problems, one can get through Facebook, you know. So in the sense that I think, you know, if you're a dialectician, you don't see anything else. You work with what's possible within the system, right? And in that sense, I'm more partial. And again, we're just conjecturing here, but I'm more partial to using the master's tools. And hegemony will always be limited in a sense that there will, as much as Facebook may know information about us, you know, they can't. They don't know everything at once, right? They're always trying to catch up with the kind of uncertainties of human behavior, and the same goes with media in general, right? But Facebook aside, there are other forms of media that you can use to present alternative forms of propaganda, counter propaganda, right? So that's my sense. I don't know what that would look like. I think some people are doing that in Malaysia. You know, Fahmi Reza has these nice posters that goes viral. You know, it's really catchy. It's really well done, and you know, it's a form of propaganda in a way, but it counters the dominant narrative. Project Dialogue is releasing the series of small short video tutorials on freedom of religion in Malaysia. You know, using much of the same tropes that mainstream media does, but it's for a different message, right?
And this is a project that you're involved in.
Correct.
So you're doing propaganda for yourself here.
Correct.
Okay. Well, you know, we will have to come back to the question of hegemony, I think.
Sure, definitely.
And most recently, a copy of Antonio Gramsci's Prison Notebooks have fallen to my hands.
A classic, a vintage copy, right?
Yeah,
it's a good one.
And so, you know, maybe the onus will be on me to present some of those ideas. But it's been a fascinating discussion. So propaganda is everywhere, but resistance is possible.
And this is, you know, night school is probably one of those spaces where you can actually have, you know, quasi-resistance, perhaps.
Oh, okay, quasi-resistance. We're going to have to talk about that too. Okay, you can continue to discuss this issue with us on our Facebook page. It's BFM Night School. Or you can write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com. And I'm also on Twitter. What isn't, my handle is @SharadKutan. You've been listening to Night School with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, myself, Sharad Kutan, on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.